one word in 10, which the considerable improvements on Tuesday when I'd, if I'm going to insist on talking about vampires at length, I can probably expect to be attacked in the throat. So, you know, possibly I've brought this on myself. Anyway. So, Monday's lecture, was everyone here actually at Monday's lecture? We picked up any new people who weren't? A couple of you. Okay, it is available as a podcast on the site, the website for the summer school. And the other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Nicola to email everybody with the PowerPoint displays that I'm using. We're not allowed to put them on the web, but as registered students, I can send them to you. So if you missed the first one, you can at least listen to it with the PowerPoint. It's not particularly intrinsic, but it might make a couple of my comments slightly clearer. So very briefly, what I did in the first lecture was to talk about the vampire as a symbol and its construction, particularly in folklore. Its roots in folklore, and the way that folkloric version of the symbol translated in all sorts of fairly radical ways during the 19th century into the literary versions that various authors were producing. I talked specifically about Polidori's vampire, Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and looked at ways in which the movement into the literary world, and particularly into the Victorian British world, already started to reshape the symbol and to give it a lot of its characteristics that we actually take for granted today as clichés of the vampire were effectively created by the Victorians. So what we're doing, and what I want to do in the second lecture, is to very broadly look at the 20th century and to follow in the 20th century two particularly interesting trends that are building on what's happening to the vampire in the 19th century. The first, obviously, is the movement of the vampire into film and television, out of a strictly literary medium into the visual. This is inevitable. You're already seeing seeds of it in the popularity of the vampire as theatrical motifs in the 19th century, sort of wonderful Victorian melodramas, sort of very blood and thunder over the top symbols and all the rest of it. Use the vampire very successfully. And you can see how elements of the traditional vampire story, both the symbol and the popular narrative shape, its tendency towards adventure, thrills, danger, and in particularly that sort of upbeat resolution, the vampire is staked at the end. All of these make it very easy to adapt to a popular, accessible medium. So the vampire in film in the 20th century is a very, very powerful presence. It's also particularly suited to film because it's such a human monster. It's very easy to depict. It doesn't require particularly expensive special effects like you would need for someone to turn into a werewolf or something like that. So it's familiar. It's a good risk in terms of the expense of making a film because you don't have to put that much money into special effects. It is recognizable and popular, which means a lot of people are likely to see it. So that movement into the visual is absolutely inevitable. Side by side with it, over the course of the 20th century, we're seeing a very, very interesting move towards a deconstruction of the monster as a symbol. It's no longer just this gothic monster who is an other, who is a sort of a monstrous, dangerous, inhuman other. Instead, we are starting to try to understand it. We psychologize the vampire inexorably as the 20th century proceeds. Part of this is, I suspect, as a result of its movement into film, because with that visual persona of the identity, often with a very good-looking actor in the role, it's very easy to identify with the vampire, much more difficult to regard it simply as a monster. But of course, at the same time, this is also the result directly of Freud, generally. Late 19th century, early 20th century psychology and the idea of individualism in the 20th century in a way that was not as strong in the 19th century. The self is seen as a legitimate concern in the 20th century rather than the insistence that the Victorians might have had on the idea of identity within social structures and with the moral structures, good and evil, right and wrong, etc., etc. So the vampire as a monster becomes interesting not just because it's thrilling and dangerous, but because we also want to know what it thinks and feels, not just wanting to know what we, as the viewer or reader, think and feel. So these are, of course, not instant developments. This is a very interesting trend across the entire century and moving into the now. So the simultaneously the vampire as in some ways grotesque and monstrous and threatening, but also elements of vulnerability introduced very early in the century. And one of the best example, one of the sort of very influential films here is, of course, Murnau's Nosferatu. I don't know how many of you managed to watch the Herzog film earlier this week. Yeah, so the Herzog film is a remake of Murnau's 1922 one. This is, as I said in my introduction on Monday, this is a German expressionist film. It's silent, it's black and white. It's very, very suited, the vampire symbol is very, very suited to the symbolism, the non-realism, the kind of moodiness of the expressionist movement. You can see from these stills that I've thrown you, particularly from, I love that poster, a sort of medieval woodcut feel, the starkness and the sort of reductionism of the symbols. and you can see it in the tendency for a lot of silhouettes, use of shadow. That's a very famous silhouette going up the stairs there in the bottom. The vampire is grotesque in Murnau's vision of it. It's an exaggerated, grotesque, goblin-like vampire with that bald head, with the stooped posture, slight suggestion of a hunchback, and in particular the talon-like fingernails you can see there. He's creepy. This is Max Schreck in the role. Very, very interesting interpretation of it. As I said on Monday, it's an interesting film because 1922 is close enough after the publication of Dracula as the book in the late 1890s, but it was still in copyright. And Murnau could not get the rights to produce a version of Dracula explicitly. So he basically just filed for the serial numbers, he changed all the names, he moved the setting from Britain to Germany. He still got into an enormous amount of trouble, and the widow, Bram Stoker's widow, took him to court, and he had to burn most of the copies of the film because they were judged to be illegal. But it demonstrates to you, I think, a lot of the appeal of this figure, the idea that it's almost inevitable that it moves into film because of the success of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and because there is this inevitable fit between the vampire as a symbol and its visual reproduction in film. So, as I say, this grotesque and goblin-like vampire, Max Schreck's version of it, it's interesting because it's both threatening and somehow pathetic. It has an element of vulnerability or sadness. It suggests otherness, but it also suggests alienation. And you can see the seeds of this planted in Reimer's Vanya the Vampire in the early 19th century. The idea of the vampire is entrapped by his or her own nature as being a tragic as well as a monstrous figure. And this element becomes exaggerated in later texts. We see Anne Rice pick it up and run with it. You see it as an element in Buffy with vampires struggling against their own nature. But it's also, in a way, I suspect, something that was heavily influenced by Murnau himself because of the influence of German Expressionism. So German Expressionism as a film tradition was very interested in interiority, in feeling, and in particular in feeling expressed externally as symbol, as landscape, as setting. And that again becomes a very perfect fit for the kinds of things that we're starting to want from our vampire. We're trying to want to get inside rather than simply staying outside that particularly fascinating appeal that it has, that draw towards it. So, I mean, it's not an inevitable or a monolithic trajectory, if you like, right alongside the touchy-feely, I am so tragic kind of brow-clutching vampire. We also have vampires developing throughout the 20th century, very much in the Vanya mode, the thrilling bloodsucker, who's the focus of a pulp horror narrative. But quite as you move later and later into the 20th century, a lot of these texts synthesize the two trends. Give you, and as I said in the first lecture, this unbelievable tension at the heart of the vampire between attraction and repulsion, between desire to understand and desire to run the hell away because this thing is dangerous, becomes very much an intrinsic part of its appeal. And I think the pulp horror thing the sort of aspect of the vampire that is slightly cheesy and very much about cheap thrills, owes quite a lot to the London stage production of the early 20th century. One of the great influences on the 20th century was the adaptation, this time legally, by a London theatre producer called Hamilton Dean, of Bram Stoker's Dracula into a stage version. So the London stage version opened in 1924, starring Raymond Huntley doing the sort of cape thing, as you can see there in the picture, awful lot of very white grease paint, very schlocky, thrilling kind of framing of it, as you can see from the movie poster there, sorry, theatre poster there. Hamilton Dean's version is actually based on the very bad, very short-lived, very unsuccessful play version of Dracula, which Stoker actually tried a couple of years before he produced the novel. He was, if you remember, a theatrical producer. And he tried his version of Dracula as a stage play. It ran for about 2 weeks or something and then crashed ignominiously. But in those couple of weeks, Hamilton Dean actually saw it, was very impressed by it, asked permission to do something with it, and made a much more successful version of it. It wasn't quite a West End production, but it was a very high status London theatrical production. He used very much, he almost enshrined in some ways the idea of the vampire not just as an aristocrat, but as a slightly debonair aristocrat who's capable of passing as an upper-class gentleman. Like Lord Ruthven, he encapsulated this appeal, this desire to be in society and to be popular in society because people are fascinated by him. This is where the classic cliché of Dracula in a tuxedo and a high-collared cape actually originates. It goes back to the 1924 London stage production with Raymond Huntley in the title role. Apparently this was partially, according to at least internet law, I have no idea how apocryphal this is, this was at least partially to save money, because they could put him in a tuxedo on stage and then he could go off to all the theatrical after parties and not have to actually change his clothes, which was, you know, usefully thrifty, if nothing else. I also sometimes wonder if the early 20th century theatrical grease paint tradition, you can see how pale his face is in this. Stoker's Dracula is described as being very pale. When Harker first meets him in Dracula, he's described as having an extraordinary pallor, which is an element that Stoker introduces to the myth. The folkloric vampire is not pale. Because the folkloric vampire drinks blood, they are in fact unusually ruddy in complexion. You can see the blood in their cheeks and sometimes in some versions, if they've killed enough people recently, the blood oozes through their skin. You find a coffin full of blood as an indicator of a vampire. But Stoker instead takes this in the opposite direction. He makes the vampire pale rather than red. The only way you keep that vivid blood redness is in the lips, which I sometimes darkly suspect Stoker might have had something of an oral fixation because he spends a hell of a lot of time talking about the redness of vampires' lips. But the stage production, if you like, picks up on that with that heavy grease paint. And you see the vampire as this pale, interesting, red-lipped, aristocratic figure in this visual sense. It was very successful in London, the 1924 stage production. And it moved over to America in 1927 to even greater success. It ran on Broadway for years. And the theatrical poster I have up there is actually from the American version rather than the English. You can see because it's dramatized by Hamilton Dean and John L. Balderston, who is the American who adapted it. It's generally considered to be a better theatrical version than the American one. It's quite a major adaptation from Dean's original London one. But the American theatrical version is also deeply significant in that it starred in its Broadway run the Hungarian actor Bela Lugosi in the title role of the theatrical version. And of course, he is one of the great early 20th century vampire actors. And so we're moving on now to the inevitable movement from this very successful theatrical identity of the vampire, of Dracula's particularly. We now move into burgeoning Hollywood in the 1920s and the inevitable translation of the vampire into film. Dracula in 1931 was one of the first in Universal's very, very successful and long-running series of monster movies. They did stuff with monsters right up until the 60s. And not just Dracula, Frankenstein, werewolves, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, a whole lot of them. But what they did was for the 1931 Dracula, directed by Todd Browning, they adapted the stage play for the theatre, and they brought across Bela Lugosi, the theatrical actor, into the filmic role, which would become one of the defining versions of Dracula in cinema. That's him there. That very pale face, the very marked eyebrows, the very heavy Hungarian accent. Urban legend has it that he didn't actually speak English at the time of making the film and had to learn everything phonetically, which I believe is untrue, but it does add quite nicely to the mystique and to the identification of the vampire with foreignness, with otherness, with difference. He picks up on the Hamilton Dean version in that he's also a much more debonair vampire than Stoker's one ever was. He's a very interesting cinematic presence. He's aristocratic, he's very smiling and courteous and rather urbane, but with this air of restrained menace. His movements are very slow and deliberate and rather unsettling. And he comes across on the cinema version with this kind of disturbing intensity. The film makes an awful lot of his hypnotic gaze. So while Stoker does touch on this, does touch on the ability that Dracula has to hold you mentally in thrall, Todd Browning's film just runs with it. He can glare at you. You get these enormous sort of close-ups into the sort of staring eyes of Bela Lugosi in this role, rather freakily. Awful lot of zombie-like maidservants and what have you bumping around the place because they have been enthralled by the vampire and have to do as they're told, effectively. It's also an interesting cinematic vampire because there is so little gore in it. You barely see blood in this film. Everything is very slow, very deliberate, and at any point at which Dracula is about to bite a victim, as he bends down towards the throat for the kill, basically, there'll be a cutaway or a fade where you never actually see that moment of bite, which adds a lot, I think, to the restraint of the film, its air of withheld menace, rather than being an obvious, upfront, titillating thriller. It is always a female victim. You don't see him biting a male victim in this. Interestingly, the film replaces Jonathan Harker in the initial sequences. It's not Harker who visits Dracula in Transylvania, it's actually Renfield, who's the mental patient in the novel. And so they've translocated that incarceration in the castle and presumably a bite from Dracula, but you never see it. It's off screen onto this Renfield figure who subsequently goes insane and starts eating flies and spiders in order to absorb their life force and work his way up the chain, presumably aspiring to eat people. So this element of restraint in this visualization of it, it's a very compelling film. And you can see how I've given you a slightly larger version of the poster thing there. The focus is on a romanticized interaction in a lot of ways. These helpless, kind of dazzled females, absolutely unable to escape the lure of the vampire, they just stand there and allow him to bite them. And this is quite a contrast in some ways to the equally famous sort of parallel set of films to the Universal ones, which of course is the Hammer Dracula film starring Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee's the other great great cinematic vampire. Hammer Dracula films, and there were about seven of them, of increasing shockiness and absolute lack of narrative merit. They make no real pretense at reflecting Stoker's story, which the Todd Browning 1931 film does. It's quite an interesting adaptation of Stoker specifically. It focuses and trims down the story in very effective ways. But the Hammer Dracula films go the other way. While Christopher Lee does have a sense of seduction, he's a very sort of, it's not quite seduction, he's a very feral, rather predatory presence in these films. Unlike Bela Lugosi's urbane, charming, smiling Dracula, this is a much more threatening Dracula. It has much more kind of sexual energy, I think, than the restraint of the Lugosi version. And obviously, being later, so the Hammer Draculas are running between 1958 and 1973. And obviously they're in color, which gives you a huge advantage if you're talking about vampires. Very difficult to talk about vampires in black and white if you can't show black as anything, you know, dazzling in the way that it should be. But at the same time, there is also the relaxation of codes about the representation of violence. So you get the kind of thing you're getting there at the end of the very bloody bitten woman, showing quite a lot of cleavage, to say the least. Very much less restrained than that tactful, polite cutting away at the last minute so that you never actually see blood or gore or naked lady bits, basically. So in a lot of ways, the bloodiness of the Christopher Lee films hark back to Varney, to that penny dreadful schlock sort of element. They're much less thoughtful than certainly Bela Lugosi's one. And of course, it's not just relaxing codes about the depiction of violence, it's also increasing sophistication of special effects, which are always the big bugbear of any sort of supernatural or horror movie. It's how to make that violence actually compelling and realistic so that the sort of problems of it the recreation of it don't pop you out of the film. I find watching the Bela Lugosi one is problematical because of all its damn stuffed bats hanging around. They pop them down from ceilings on a string, and you can see they're bouncing on the string. It kind of destroys the the mood for me every single time. We get very spoiled by that contemporary CGI. So the Christopher Lee, the first one was 1958, but as I say, he was making them right up till 1973. It's in the middle of the century, has a lot of vampire presence in films, but mostly in the Hammer style, fairly gory, fairly adventure style, classic horror films. While there is the seductive subtext of Christopher Lee being predatory and intense and biting women, in a sense it's subsidiary to the focus on the violence, on the gore, basically. Which makes Herzog's remake of Murnau's Nosferatu a particularly interesting departure. So you can see how these two elements are running parallel throughout the 20th century. On the one hand, the celebration of the vampire as a figure of violence, of horror, of titillation, of shock. And simultaneously, the celebration of the vampire as a symbol of more complex things, including interiority, including seduction. And returning back to both to the Murnau version and to the hint of it in Varney the Vampire, that sense of vulnerability. Both Herzog and Murnau's version of the vampire are these grotesque, goblin-like vampires. And I find them particularly interesting because, if nothing else, because of the way that they interpret the fangs. If you have a look at the picture there where he's about to, was just with Jonathan Harker, the extended fangs in both Herzog and you saw it, in fact, in the Murnau version as well. The teeth that are elongated are not the canines, they're incisors. So the classic modern vampire elongates the canines, which is very much a predatory sort of thing. So that harks to a wolf or a cat or something like that. These elongated incisors come across as rat-like more than cat-like or dog-like. So it's a much more abject, almost, representation. It's not the romanticized, I am a wolf kind of thing. It's much more debased and fits into, I think, that sense of grotesqueness. It also explains partially and contributes very nicely to the absolutely amazing things that Herzog does in this film with disease. Those of you who saw it on Monday, has those unbelievably slow, dreamlike sequences with the ship that Dracula is traveling on over the course of its travels from Transylvania. He kills the entire crew. He's basically sleeping in a box of graveyard dirt in the hold of the ship and coming out at night to eat people. So you have this kind of Mary Celeste abandoned ship sliding ghost-like into the harbor with a horde of rats pouring off it and infecting the city. And then you get these strange Mask of the Red Death, almost carnivalesque scenes of people dying from plague, but going completely mad, having dinners in the streets and things with rats everywhere. So the elongated incisors play right into that, because that visual effect is rat-like. It's not wolf-like. It's not the great noble predator. It's the small, nasty, disease-ridden predator, contributing very, very interestingly to that sense of horror, of decay, of the presence of death and corruption as a grotesque motif, not necessarily as a romantic motif. I find the film interesting as well because of the adaptations it makes to Stoker's story. It does some quite radical things to Stoker's story. It doesn't allow Van Helsing and his merry band of stake-wielding maniacs to pursue Dracula back to Transylvania and stake him in his coffin in the crypt. Instead, it allows Jonathan's wife, who for some reason in this version is Lucy Harker, not Mina Harker. They've swapped Lucy and Mina's names around. I have no idea why. But they allow her to effectively seduce the vampire back in order to kill him. Instead of the men reasserting phallic control by staking him, what happens is that Lucy Harker works out that if she can persuade the vampire to stick around with her until dawn, the sunlight will destroy him. And there's a very interesting scene, the scene which you've got there. You can see in this one, her hand is coming up. In that scene, as he bites her, he moves forward very, very slowly. You see the teeth sinking in. He drinks from her. He starts to move away, having worked his wicked will, etc. And she puts her arm up and pulls him back down. In a sense, she reciprocally seduces the vampire. She keeps him hanging around until the sun rises and he's killed. So it's in the 70s, you're starting to see an interrogation, at any rate, of that relentless phallicism of the vampire symbol, the way in which it is always illegitimate phallic authority that is brought back into the fold by legitimate phallic authority by sticking a stake through the vampire's heart and a man, generally, behind the stake. Here, the woman has a lot more power. It's slightly futile power, because in the meantime, Jonathan has already been bitten, and he's quietly turning into a vampire down in the parlor where she's fenced him in with consecrated host. And she's dead, the vampire's dead. Jonathan gets up in vampiric form and rides out into the world, presumably to carry on, you know, biting people. So it's got quite a nice, rather black undercutting of that whole popular shape of the vampire narrative, which says evil threatening monster, lots of screaming girls, chase it down, lots of buckets of blood, happy ending when you kill the monster and social order is restored. This is a very good example of the idea of a thoughtful vampire film, one that uses the symbol to interrogate a lot of social structures that are taken for granted by the layers of the symbol. So the sexuality inherent in the vampire develops very strongly in the 20th century. And obviously this has a lot to do with the visual format, which allows the directors of these movies to cast an awful lot of very beautiful Hollywood starlets as the ladies being bitten. It tends throughout large chunks of the 20th century to be very mainstream sexual representation, i.e. the Hammer Dracula, for example, only really ever bites women. If men need to be bitten, one of his vampire brides will do the biting. So it's very heterosexualized, heteronormative, if you like. there was sexual representation. It's interesting that by the 1970s, Herzog is able to subvert this. By this stage, things have freed up a bit, but he can actually show a homoerotically subtexted scene of here, Nosferatu biting Jonathan Harker, in a way that just simply was not possible in 1922 when Bela Lugosi was doing it. So the film is able to make very good use of the sexual charge of the vampire encounter, that moment of submission to intimate contact, that moment of penetration, the exchange of bodily fluids, all those things that make the vampire bite an inherently sexual act. It's interesting, though, that while the 20th century is obviously more open about representing sexuality than the 19th century, cinema from 1930 to 1968 was still bound by the Hays Code, which severely limited the kind of risque and violent stuff that you could stick on the screen. Explicitly, it prohibited, and I'm quoting, any licentious or suggestive nudity in fact or in silhouette, and any lecherous or licentious notice thereof by other characters in the picture. It also, and I quote, prohibited any inference of sex perversion. So it's interesting to me that given those parameters of the Hays Code, when you weren't allowed to do nudity, and you weren't allowed to do sexual perversion, in exactly the same way that the Victorians were using vampires to talk about things they couldn't, film is able to use vampires to represent things that the Hays Code says that they can't. For a start, sexual perversion. The vampire bite is a sadomasochistic sexual relationship which you cannot represent under the Hays Code in any sort of realistic sense. But you certainly can in symbolic sense. And that whole idea of, and I love their wording here, licentious or suggestive nudity and lecherous or licentious notice thereof by other characters. Vampire films fetishize the neck. If you watch a vampire movie, they tend to spend an awful lot of time doing slow pans down the throat and into the cleavage. So you come up with this idea of lateral representation, the representation of the nude body by the nude throat, in a way that bypasses the Hays Code and still manages to pack quite a lot of erotic charge into a lot of these films. Later in the century, particularly from the 1970s onwards, and I think you can see elements of this in what Herzog's doing here with the change to the story, the vampire as a symbolic vehicle for representing sexuality becomes very complicated by the feminist movement, which was hitting fairly strident sort of tracts of its development in the 1970s. The feminist movement very, very badly problematizes the idea of the willing and helpless surrender of a female figure to a hyper-masculinized predator. In terms of what feminism says, that idea of the pleasures of submission which the vampire symbol encodes is totally illegitimate. So, once again, you see another sort of parallel to what the Victorians were doing. You can't talk about sadomasochistic submission in the 1970s in the way that you can in 50 Shades of Bloody Grey today, because the feminist movement is down on like a ton of bricks. But once again, it moves laterally into the symbol in film, and absolutely fine. I think the feminists probably had quite a lot to say about vampire film, but no one takes it seriously. It's one of the great subversive potentials of popular representation of any sort, is that the sort of literary mainstream, the critical mainstream, tend not to take much notice of it, which means you can get away with an awful lot. So this increasing sense of sexuality in the vampire throughout the 20th century, and simultaneously this increasing focus on the interiority of the vampire, almost inevitably give rise to one of the great influential figures in the vampire of the 20th century, which is the writer Anne Rice. Anne Rice's first novel, Interview with the Vampire, was 1976. She thereafter wrote a whole series of what she called the Vampire Chronicles, which became increasingly self-indulgent and sprawling narratives without much editorial control or, and as far as I'm concerned, fairly clearly decreasing literary merit. But what you've got there are the stills from Neil Jordan's film version of Interview with the Vampire, which was 1994, which I'll talk about in a moment. But Anne Rice has had enormous effects on the vampire, and particularly on the version of the vampire that we're starting to see in contemporary texts like Twilight, The Vampire Diaries. The idea of that hyper-focus on the psychology and interiority of the vampire. She's coming out of a literary environment that has a strong, with the sort of horror genre, has a strong overlap with the fantasy science fiction readership, this idea of fantastic fiction of one sort or another. And what she's doing with the vampire effectively sparks off what is now the paranormal romance trend, which is romance novels with vampires and werewolves and goodness knows what else. Oh my. We're seeing here the idea of the individuality of the vampire, and we're seeing it in the sense that for the first time what we have is differentiated vampires. Rice is basically going, vampires are people just like us. Some of them are Varney-style, Nosferatu-style, struggling against their own natures. They do not wish to kill people. Others are cheerfully psychotic killers. And she weaves this kind of conflict between those two poles of the vampires into her stories as conflicts between vampires of those differing natures. So the vampire has become a lot more humanized in one gesture there. Instead of a single monolithic monster, we now have a range of possible monsters, of possible monstrosities, and of possible levels of acceptance of the monstrosity inherent in that vampiric symbol. So this denial of that monolithic category of monster actually reflects in some ways its contemporary sociological views of criminality. The idea that you don't just punish by sticking a stake through a criminal. You try and understand them. You try and work out what made them criminal in the first place. And what this allows, of course, what this perpetrates and underlines is that idea of fascination. That the vampire is a fascinating figure that becomes a lot more frank. You're not just interested in the push-pull attraction of desire and violence. You are also interested in the push-pull interaction of self with monstrosity. So Interview with the Vampire is her best novel as far as I'm concerned. As far as I'm concerned, they go downhill quite severely from there onwards. It features a young reporter interviewing Louis, who is a 200-year-old vampire who's at the I am struggling with my own nature, woe is me end of the scale of vampire identity. It's a confessional, intimate, first-person narrative. It's the first time you're seeing the vampire speaking for himself. This is my life, this is what I am, this is how I came to be, this is why it's difficult and horrible. And this element exists in tension with I think, Anne Rice's fairly uncomplicated fascination with and desire for a lot of the things that the vampire represents. The atmosphere of her writing is very powerful. It's got this kind of heavy, sultry sort of feel. You can see it in, this is Neil Jordan's wonderful film. This is a very interesting vampire text. It's one of the, as far as I'm concerned, one of the great vampire texts in cinema. It's not a flawless film, but what it does, what it embodies, what it renders visual, that's kind of tucked into Rice's writing is very, very powerful. You can see this kind of opulent period feel. It's a lot of it is the past of the vampires sort of 200 years ago. It's set initially in New Orleans, which is the start of a huge, huge fetish for vampires in the New Orleans kind of setting. That has been picked up by subsequent vampire writers. Sookie Thakkar's novels by Charlene Harris are also set in Louisiana, and they play with that Anne Rice-created sense of the sort of sultriness of New Orleans as a good fit for the sultriness of the vampire. So Louis is a young plantation owner way back in colonial sort of America. He loses his father and family. He's all distraught and seeking death. Lestat, the vampire, finds him, persuades him that what he actually wants to be is a vampire, bites him, turns him into a vampire. The two of them have this bizarrely close, extremely homoerotically charged relationship, sort of intense friendship. They move through the world together for 200 years, killing, or in the case of Louis, trying not to kill. Somewhere along the line of this claustrophobic love-hate relationship over several continents, they also pick up Claudia, who is a six-year-old girl. They change into a vampire. She's a very interesting figure because, of course, her body doesn't change. She's a six-year-old girl forever. but she gets older inside it. She's a very freaky figure because you're seeing embodied in her that paradox of eternal youth and enormous age. It's also in Neil Jordan's film version, the first appearance of a very young Kirsten Dunst, very, very effectively in the role. So Rice's novels are unabashedly pulpy, but also very powerfully erotic. They are often deliberately and openly homoerotic. They have a very huge fan following. They develop the appeal of the vampire in the very specific terms of its perpetual youth, its amorality, and its freedom as an identity on the edge of, outside of society. So unlike Dracula's crumbling castles, Rice's novels feature vampires who are into wealth and luxury. They're always surrounded by possessions. You can see it in the clothing. Again, Jordan has picked up on this very interestingly in his film version. So in a sense, she becomes highly popular in the 1980s, which is, of course, the great consumerist age. So that element of consumerism starts to become very powerful as a shadow to the idea of the vampire's power in a supernatural sense, physical strength, mind powers, whatever, becomes the element where the vampire, in addition to all of those, is also wealthy, becomes exaggerated and focused on. It's part of the appeal. It's one of the things that certainly you can see Rice desiring it as she writes. Her readers certainly desire it as they read. This reaches its logical sort of apotheosis in the late 20th century. A very interesting series of films, Blade 2, Blade Trinity, based on a comic book novel about a black half-vampire hunter. The vampires in Blade wear suits, are corporate individuals. You have these amazing sort of corporate council scenes. That's all vampires. So it moves that idea of power into the idiom of the moment, which at that point is very much about wealth and corporate power. So Neil Jordan's film version of this is sumptuous. It's visually very, very rich. It's also, and I'm gonna come back to this in the second lecture, but it also is absolutely essential in terms of who's cast here. So Neil Jordan's 1994 film version casts as the two vampires with the strong homoerotic charge, Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, who at that moment in history are probably the two major sex symbol stars. Okay. So this is an incredibly important moment in this. The moment when the appeal of the vampire and the desire to succumb to its powers becomes very overtly linked to notions of mortality, which are tied specifically to youth and to beauty. And that's really where Edward kind of gets off. So I find Rice quite uncritical. I find her, she succumbs in a sense to her own writing in terms of the appeal of the vampire. She's not a very thoughtful deconstructor of some of the implications that she's very powerfully representing, particularly the idea of the appeal of immortality, the appeal of wealth, the appeal of this hedonistic existence these two lead, freewheeling across two continents for 200 years, doing what the hell they like. It's very much an ideal of freedom and freedom from social constraint. So what we need as an antidote to this, obviously, is Buffy. Right, this is, as far as I'm concerned, the great vampire text. Unashamed Buffy fan here. So. Whedon's Buffy the Vampire Slayer television show ran from 1997 to 2003. It sort of came out of the 1992 movie, which was terrible. Us Buffy fans do not talk about the movie. We pretend it didn't actually exist. So Whedon's television show was actually run by him. The film, I think, got out of his creative control and got made into something that he really didn't want it to be made into. But he had complete creative control of Buffy, and it is, for its seven seasons, one of the great examples both of teen high school television and of horror television, and comedy television in a lot of ways. So the nice thing about Joss Whedon is that he self-identifies as a feminist, and he's absolutely upfront about the deconstructive things that he tries to do with his shows. So the tagline that he himself in interviews has given to Buffy is to say, this is high school as a horror movie, unquote. So it takes the idea of your average high school experience and it uses the symbols and tropes of horror to explicate and unwrap and explore the kinds of issues and angst and desires and fears that your average teenager has. So Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the Slayer is this destined, hyper-powerful superhero type female figure whose duty and kind of destiny it is to slay vampires. She is a blonde high school girl called Buffy who has superpowers. Okay. She saves the world a lot. At one point, it's on her tombstone. So she's presented in these seven seasons of the series as a slightly, in some ways, bimbo-ish blonde high school girl who's not the cheerleader type, but who tends to hang around on the edges of high school society with a bunch of fellow misfits, geeks, other marginal kinds of characters. So it's teen television, but it is particularly acute, funny, well-written teen television that is above all a very serious and deconstructive take on the vampire mythology and has a strong awareness of its power as a symbol. It's often very funny. Picks up on an interesting tendency from the 1970s onwards to exploit the vampire as parody because it's such a strongly drawn symbol. It's very easy to exploit for comic effect. So 1967 was Roman Polanski's The Fearless Vampire Killers, or, pardon me, Your Teeth Are in My Neck, which is a slapstick, ridiculous thing that's had a lot of fun to watch. There's also Blackula, which is a blaxploitation version of, it's about 1972, 73, somewhere around there, black vampire figure, again, played for larks. I put up on the first PowerPoint, the one little image I've got there is of Count von Count, who is the Sesame Street version of Dracula, which is once again a parodic version. So part of that awareness of the inherent absurdity of part of this of the symbol is quite implicated in what Whedon is doing with the series. He plays a lot with the clash of expectations, traditional vampires meeting, in this case, the 20th century modern teen life. But what is refreshing, particularly after Rice, and after the sort of universal horror-style schlocky vampire versions, is that this is a deliberately and explicitly feminist project. It picks up on the vampire as a symbol of hyper-masculinity, and it uses Buffy the Vampire Slayer to deconstruct that, sometimes literally with a stake, you know, so they all crumble to dust. So Joss Whedon has said that he is deliberately attempting to subvert the trope of, and I quote, the little blonde girl who goes into a dark alley and gets killed in every horror movie, unquote. The slasher film. Slasher film kills little blonde girls, you know, about one every 10 minutes in the worst versions of it. So what he's imagining is the idea where the little blonde girl goes off on her own in the way that they all do in horror movies, although it's clearly stupid, goes into the dark alley. The monster tries to get her, and she gets it back. Okay, so it's a deliberate, very deliberate feminine power. Whedon says the very first mission statement of the show was the joy of female power, having it, using it, sharing it. So it's a head-on engagement with the elements of phallicism in the vampire symbol, with the gothic roots of the trope in those passive, violated female bodies that are so common to gothic literature, and to its encoding of male dominance as both inevitable and fascinating. It's not a flawless project. It's commercial television. His Fox, who hosted the show, messed with him a lot. He didn't always get to do what he wanted. Quite a lot of the time, Buffy's clothing is way more tight and revealing than really it should be for such a feminist project. But nonetheless, I think the show does amazing things in depicting and unwrapping some of the things that are going on in the symbol. So Buffy vampires are interesting, very quickly, running out of time. They are a very deliberate attempt to undermine the romance and restraint of the cliché in so many of its other iterations. Rather than the bedrooms or castles, the Buffy vampire assaults his victims or her victims usually in an urban back alley. There's none of this seduction coming in through your window, you lie there helplessly, etc. These are violent assaults. They are coded as rape rather than seduction, if you're looking at the sort of sexual underpinning to the way that they're represented. Vampires don't just grow fangs. Okay, so this is game face, which is the show's term for what happens. The top version is what the vampire looks like normally. This is Angel, this is Spike, these are two of Buffy's vampire boyfriends at various points during the show. So at the point where they want to bite someone, they morph. The face becomes bumpy and animalistic, the teeth grow out, the eyes go yellow, the sort of wrinkliness and bumpiness effectively does not allow you to romanticize this bite. This is an animal attack. There's a lot of blood in Buffy. A lot of these, some of these vampires put two discrete holes in your neck, but an awful lot of them rip your throat out. Okay, so he does not allow you, in the way that the series is set up, to retreat into the consolation of that, oh, but it's such a discreet little wound. Not happening. You are not being bitten by Bela Lugosi looking suave and urbane. You're being bitten by something that looks violent and animalistic and terrifying. It does have some of the, you saw here, some of the older vampires get like this. This is the Murnau Herzog-style vampire, the grotesque goblinoid type. They are so old that they no longer have the human form. But most of them are like this. Quite a lot of them are Buffy's schoolmates who become vampires. Teen boys, teen girls, etc. The series is most interesting when it allows Buffy as the vampire slayer to engage head-on with that romantic vampire trope, in that several of her relationships in the course of the series are with vampires. Once again, this is the Anne Rice thing of not all vampires are the same. Angel, her first boyfriend, is a vampire cursed with a soul. This means he has a morality which most vampires don't. In the show's mythology, if you're bitten by a vampire, you die as an individual. Your soul goes straight to heaven. Your body retains an imprint of your memory and personality, but the real you is gone. It is now a demon in your place. Angel's great tragedy is that he becomes a demon when he's turned into a vampire, royally pisses off a gypsy, and gets cursed to have his soul returned to him so that he is simultaneously a vampire with all of the bloodlusts and immorality of the vampire, and a human with a soul, which is the show's shorthand for morality and feelings. Spike picks up an artificial soul. Someone sticks a chip in his head that doesn't allow him to attack humans. Has exactly the same effect. They end up becoming that vampire trope of the vampire struggling against their own nature. Whedon allows for some very, very powerful relationships between Buffy and these two vampires particularly, but he does not glamorize them. Buffy has a terrible love life. Buffy's love life is like trauma and angst like you would not believe. At various points in the show, she has to kill her boyfriends because they have gone bad, or it's the only way to serve the world, save the world, or what have you. She gets threats of rape, she gets... they really are very unpleasant to her. He does not allow that classic thing that the vampire trope does, which is to celebrate submission. Buffy doesn't submit, and the idea of the attraction to the vampire is very, very firmly problematized. You are not allowed to believe that if you want to get together with one of these violent, dangerous, unrestrained individuals, that it's all going to be easy. You will suffer, and she does. It's also interesting, and I'm just going to finish on this because that is our time. It's one of the few shows where you start to see quite a lot of attention paid to female vampires. Most of the mainstream horror sort of schlocky action movie things don't show a lot of female vampires. Some of the female vampire figures in Buffy the Vampire Slayer are very interesting. This is Drusilla, who's completely insane. Sees the future, mad as a... flocks of bats, I think. And the show's got some quite interesting recurring tropes with being quite rude about vampire fetishists. You're always running across little cults who want to worship vampires and they're all wonderful and Anne Rice and broody. And really bad things happen to those people. Really bad things. So, end of the 20th century, you're seeing a sudden growth in vampire texts. And I think... I will talk about that at the start of the first lecture. But you can see there's a very, very rich cinematic history and series of images that is, in a sense, starting to gain momentum towards the end of 20th century. Vampire text, vampire TV series, vampire films are becoming more and more common, more and more taken for granted, and they're starting to do a wider and wider range of diverse and interesting, and in some cases, intelligent things. So what I want to do in the final lecture is to look specifically at our contemporary vampires. I'll look at Twilight, Vampire Diaries, True Blood, and to talk about some of the elements that those depict that grow out of here, of the kind of thing we've seen now, and that also take it in quite specific new directions. I believe we reconvene here at 2:30, which will hopefully give my voice a chance to recharge. Thank you.